All right, good Sunday, everyone. Hope that y'all are staying safe out there. Obviously, it's going to be a little different tenor to these pods for a while, but we are going to keep going, doing it once a week on Sunday nights. So hope that you will continue to join us during these times and to the extent you can continue to support us and also The Athletic, theathletic.com/PER, who are going to be doing some good writing while the leagues are on hiatus. There's still going to be plenty of stuff to talk about. So hope that you guys can continue to support sports journalism, obviously, to the extent you can. I know you have a lot of disruptions in your own lives as well. But and at the end of this, we'll talk a little bit more about just what some of the things that you can do just overall to help out with the COVID-19 crisis in your life. But I know you're not listening to this probably to hear about that. We want to at least be a little bit of an escape. And so I think what we want to focus on here is at some point, this is going to be over. It may not seem like it now. And so what are we going to do? What is the NBA going to do when the crisis has ended? And so John has written a lot about that this week. And wanted to first ask you, John, number one, how you guys are holding up right now.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a brave new world here, obviously, but we're doing all right down here. So, you know, just trying to socially distance and wash our hands and do all the right things. So,
well, the world misses you being out in public, but I know it's for the greater good right now. So this is the way I wanted to frame this. Let's just start with this. I mean, there are a lot of practical realities about restarting the season, which we'll get to. But I wanted to just start first. Fantasyland, you've got carte blanche. The NBA season restarts. You know, we'll obviously have to talk about when we think that's going to be. But the NBA season restarts, you know, whether it's June, July, August, September, maybe even as early as May. But how are we going to do it? So what I want to start with is, assume there's going to be a playoffs. How are we going to figure out who's in the playoffs? And do you just start with the playoffs or do you just start with the regular season first?
I think one of the biggest questions that the league will face is basically 16 or 30, right, when they restart. Are they going to tell 14 teams, like, you know what, it's not even worth it to have you, like, do all this just to play six games and then head to the summer? Because whatever they come back for, like, they're not going to play out the remaining 19 games of the schedule, right? Like, that's not
going to
happen.
That does seem unlikely.
Yeah. So the question becomes, is it even worth the trouble to bring those teams back for a smaller number of games? That may be dictated somewhat by financial considerations, but I think the other thing you have to be realistic about here is that when they do come back, if it's empty arenas, they probably can come back much, much sooner. And that's going to be a major factor in their decision making. And so for that reason, I do expect, the more I've thought about this, even since I wrote about it at the end of last week, I mean, this is just, the situation has developed so much in just a couple of days that it seems to me that it would be a very long time before you could get approval by all the necessary authorities and all the necessary jurisdictions to, which includes not even our own country, but Canada, to have home games with 20,000 fans in all 30 venues, right? So immediately you're looking at something different, whether that's playing in their home arenas with no crowds, or it may be taking everybody to one place. There are arguments for doing that. You can get in a lot more games more quickly. You can probably reduce some of the risk associated with travel and whatnot. And you can select your destination in such a way that, it would hopefully be minimally impactful to the larger community wherever you go to, but also, to the players and coaches themselves, that if you're someplace where it's not that prevalent in the population at that point.
You know, I was said in the intro, like, oh, you know, let's just try to make this fantasy land. Let's try to detach from the news. But obviously, that's not really going to be possible now that I think about it. I mean, because honestly, what this takes is some prediction over what the world is going to be like, what it's going to take to end this crisis, what the prerequisites are for it to be safe, number one, to resume NBA games, Mm-hmm. And number two, to just resume normal life at all. I mean, I think to even resume NBA games, what would have to happen in your mind for it to be? I mean, obviously, we're not, you know, public health experts, we're not epidemiologists, yeah. but I mean, we've been following this a lot. We know, I think, pretty well what the risks of this disease are and what some of the transmissibility is, and the fact that you could be asymptomatic and still transmit the disease, all that stuff. So given all of that, I mean, for them to just start playing again in empty arenas, like, what do you think the prerequisites for that
are? I think two things would need to happen. One, bending back the curve. So in other words, there needs to be some indication that this is actually under control.
That being just for to play in empty arenas.
Yeah. And the second thing, widespread testing.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you were able to test regularly or be able to test the players and know that sort of everyone is clean and then everybody is stayed clean for 2 weeks, then you could probably start playing, right? But in the absence of those two things, it's going to be really hard to restart. On a sunnier note, you raise an interesting point that this situation is so unique that it almost gives the league carte blanche to try literally anything. And it could lead
the league and the players union, in agreement, but yeah.
It could lead to some very productive experimentation. Sure. Most obviously in terms of the play-in tournament.
Yeah. Well, here, let's table that for just a second here to just talk about like what would need to happen for them to even start first. But I think I agree with you. Like, you basically, number one, there would have to be widespread enough testing. And also, obviously, to the point where you're not taking tests away from people who need it, right? I mean, that's going to be, you know, people who actually are symptomatic. NBA players just who aren't showing any symptoms, like, shouldn't be getting tested until we have enough testing kits for everyone.
Restarting the NBA comes second to a public health crisis, right? I mean, that's clear and obvious. Yeah.
Yeah. So presumably, you know, a month or two, maybe we have enough testing for everyone that needs to be done. I mean, I think at some point, just to have everyone in the entire country tested would be a really good idea. But that's just my thought. I don't know what public health people think of that. But just so people can know what their status is and make informed decisions. But so let's say you're able to test everyone in the NBA, right? So, I mean, the realistically, that couldn't happen for at least a month and a half, 2 months at the earliest, I would think, right?
You would think. I mean, we're not experts in this field, but ramping up the testing capability has seemed to be going slowly, certainly.
And so then you also had the issue that it's not like okay, you can tell players to self-quarantine, but can you tell the people in their houses to self-quarantine? A lot of these people have, you know, family that's all around. I'm sure players are going to want to spend time with family, spend time with friends. You don't know what they're doing. So at any time, I mean, you've got a negative on the entire NBA, right? I mean, and you can hope that you got at least all the players tested. Now there's also the traveling party too, right? It was 58 people in the Jazz traveling party. I would imagine if they restart games, they would try to really knock that down to essentially just like coaches and players. You know, I mean, I think you
I mean, to the you extent still you have, can. I mean, just from having been on the inside, I mean, you have, you know, you got the
trainers,
you got the strength coach, you got the equipment manager, you got, I mean.
Well, so you might have to just find a way to not bring the strength coach. You know, I mean, like maybe he can't go. Maybe you're bringing your two front of the bench assistant coaches and that's it.
Right.
I mean, I think they might have to really cut it down to like, you know, the trainer's got to be there. You know, the team doctor's got to be there. I mean, you just cut it down to like, you know, what a high school team would be, basically. I mean, what you just absolutely require, you know, the equipment manager absolutely required to play the game. No executives. I mean, they're just like, those people aren't essential to play the game, right? I mean, and so, but I mean, who knows? That's even if you're trying to ramp it up as fast as possible and you know, but then you have the problem of like, all right, well, you know, are you really going to be monitoring the players 24/7 to make sure they're not coming in contact with people? The more I think about this,
you need it under some control in society at large, or it's going to bleed into the player pool. Yeah.
I mean, and I think So what it's going to get back to here is, I mean, so at a society level, how do things get back to normal, right? There's a few ways that happens. One is obviously there's a vaccine and it's widespread enough that then you don't have to worry about it. I mean, that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is so many people have it and recover that you have like some kind of a herd immunity. I don't think anyone wants to count on that. Number three is basically, okay, we flatten the curve enough through social distancing at the beginning here for, you know, whether it's a month, whether it's 3 months, whatever this is going to be, that we basically just decide, okay, the curve is flattened. The people, like, if you are a vulnerable population, you're still not going outside. You're still isolating, but that like normality has to return and just the risk. And again, I'm not advocating for this. I'm just saying this is one thing that, you know, might happen is where you say, all right, it's time. It's been 3 months. We can't just totally stop society. Like life has to go on at some point. The curve is flattened enough that our hospitals can handle new cases. If you're a vulnerable population, you still need to stay inside and life just kind of resumes. We just decide as a society, yeah, you know what? Some people are periodically going to be getting this. They're going to be out of commission. But we're just going to deal with the transmission of this virus, especially among populations who are healthy and hopefully can handle it. I mean, those are kind of the three scenarios that I see for like any kind of resumption of normal life, including obviously basketball games.
Yeah. And I mean, you say that, I mean, one and two would take an extended amount of time.
Yeah.
And number three is the only one that has us playing basketball games.
Yeah. I mean, when you get back to just a specific basketball lens, I mean, you really, I think if you're going to take the position that we can't play basketball games if there is any risk of those games resulting in transmission of the virus, you're going to be waiting a very, very long time. I mean, you'll essentially have to be waiting until society itself completely restarts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think you would have to just, the players and owners would just have to agree, all right, players, like for this month and a half playoff run, which will probably be a truncated one, you guys just have to agree to not interact with anyone basically, or, you know, interact only with people who are also quarantined or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like it just, if you're really going to reduce the risk down to zero or to as low as practicable, which all of us are kind of doing now, socially isolating.
Yeah. You just have everyone stay in one hotel in Saskatoon and you just go to the arena.
No,
back.
I mean like that. Yeah. You, yeah. I mean, there's even things like, you know, they'd have to have it in an area where, you know, if a player breaks a leg or something, there's gonna be a hospital bed for him. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there's that level of concern too, where have it somewhere where the hospital system is overwhelmed. So that's, I mean, like you mentioned Saskatoon, but like that's, you know, maybe they do have to just find somewhere. Like, and if they're just doing it on TV,
anywhere. You can go anywhere, right? Yeah.
Right.
And it could be almost
– have it in Bismarck, North Dakota or something if you need to, but, you know, wherever it ends up being. But yeah, I mean, there's just, and I've thought of like just in the 15 minutes we've been talking, like 97 different issues here. I mean, this is just such an unprecedented thing. I mean, I'm sure we'll look back on this podcast 2 months from now and things are actually restarting and be like, well, that was stupid. Like the way I look back on my own behavior from a week ago, frankly.
Yeah. 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 Just 20 different things that we probably haven't thought about that if you listen back to this and be like, oh, duh.
Okay. Well, now that we've established that our ideas are all completely unrealistic, let's take a break and talk about those in a second. And again, we apologize here to have to continue doing ads. I do realize it feels a little incongruous with the times that we're in, but hopefully economic life can go on to the extent possible. So we're going to try and keep the lights on here. And hopefully to the extent you guys can, you can still support us with our sponsors. But we understand, obviously, if you're not in a position to do that. But we'll be right back after this. So way back in 2009, I started getting some really bad knee pain. And eventually I was told that I needed to do a bunch of foam rolling to relieve this tendonitis. And so I got really good at it. I even started using like this hard PVC pipe, and it's just a pain. It's so difficult. It takes forever. You're just uncomfortable. It hurts a ton. You have to hold your body in these awkward positions. So that's why Jen and I were so excited to partner with Theragun. That's Theragun.com/PER. Easy to remember /PER because John invented PER. John uses it on his legs. He works at a stand-up desk. His legs will get sore. After I work out, after I go skiing, you just have these spots on your body where it feels like, oh man, I just can't get this knot out of there. And the Theragun helps you loosen up those muscles, get rid of those adhesions. Just yesterday, I used it on my lower back, my glutes, my vastus medialis. It's like the quad muscle that's on the medial side of your leg, the inside of your leg. It's also just a good way to relax before bed. Maybe you have some neck pain, just some normal. You sat in the car for a while, something like that. Theragun can help you feel better naturally, treat your pain, get you back to your life. You can try it risk-free. So if you buy it, it's not working out for you. You can get your money back. And the link to go there again is theragun.com/PR. You can even get a free charging stand, a $79 value with your purchase. That's nice because then you can charge up another battery at the same time as you're using it. This is a great deal, great product. I'm so glad to have one. It's theragun.com/PER. Once again, theragun.com/PER. Well, this one is going to be apropos for a while, I'm afraid. Postmates, not only do they deliver food, they deliver whatever you can think of from convenience stores, clothing stores, you name it. You don't have to go to the store. You don't have to leave your house to go to restaurants, which you might not want to do right now anyway. You just download the Postmates app on Apple or Android. Find your favorites on there. Get anything you want delivered within an hour. Whether it's an early morning burrito, an adult beverage or two, some sushi, Postmates can get you what you need delivered fast. For a limited time, they are giving Locked On NBA listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. They have a delivery fee, but you can get up to $100 worth of free delivery fees waived over those first 7 days with the code Locked On NBA. That's the name of our network. That's code Locked On NBA for $100 of free delivery credit. No minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Okay, so back to my original question here. Let's say they're able to restart in like June or July. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll do two scenarios. Or we'll do, okay, that's like the near-term scenario. I think that's probably it, right? Or there's the long-term scenario when it's like September or October or something. So near-term scenario, carte blanche, wave your hand. What does the league do?
30-team tournament where there's a – so, like, the bad teams go first, basically, and you give a bye to the top – I think it would be the top 14 teams. Wait, is that right? I don't think I did that right. Anyway, sort of like – it's almost like how the summer league tournament works, except the only difference is, obviously, you're playing best of five or best of seven. You probably end up shortening it to best of five in the interest of time if it's not till June when you restart. I think that's the best way to do it. You get every team back playing. You get excitement in every fan base, and you give everybody a chance. And I think it's a prelude to kind of what the play-in tournament could be. Now, you could argue you just play like four or five games or whatever just to get everybody, you know, get everybody's blood flowing. Count those as the rest of the regular season. So everyone finishes with like 70 games and then you go into the playoffs.
Yeah, that's an interesting. So you'd a 30 team tournament. And so what the, you would have like the bottom eight play each other or the bottom 16 play each other. And then explain more of like how that would work.
There are a few different ways you could do it. Cause you could do it with double buys, right? Or you could do it with, or you could do it with a single bye, where basically just the one and the two, I think, would get a bye, and everyone else plays in the first round. Which I don't know if you have the third best record in the league. If you should, I don't know. it seems a little cold to do it that way. But I don't. I mean, yeah. they have their options. Also, it's tough to have 14 different series running concurrently. If you think about it, just from the logistics
tough
for
us.
TV.
Tough for us media members trying to cover that series.
Yeah, yeah. Well. Let's get to the real issue here.
I mean, that would be pretty awesome though. Like that, it would definitely. So you would do like three game series in the early rounds, and then move to like five games in the second round, and
probably
then
something
after
like
that.
Yeah, 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 and maybe save best of seven for the finals or something. You might get to the point where you could have home arenas for the finals, but maybe not. But, you know, honestly, like, arena availability is going to be such an issue in all of this too. Or maybe not. I don't know. Like, all these arenas are booked for, like, concerts and monster truck shows.
I mean, I think all of those are going to
actually.
Yeah. All of those are going to get pushed back too. I mean, you would imagine just that these arenas all, I don't know how they did it. Like, I mean, the last time we had something like this, I think was like September 11th, where everything kind of just got put on hold and like air traffic was grounded and stuff like that. And obviously, it wasn't nearly as long of a shutdown. But I mean, you would think that they would come up with some kind of a solution here, maybe. And also, you mentioned in your piece playing during the day or the idea of doing it at neutral sites. But yeah, I mean, it does seem that you know, the concerts can be rebooked a lot more easily than professional sports. Like, I mean, it seems like I don't think they're going to just eliminate 3 months and then you just start up with whatever was booked on June 1st, right? I think they'll come up with a solution where just like everything kind of gets pushed back and rebooked and stuff. Like, you would hope that that's how it would happen instead of just like record scratch. Okay, we're ready to go here. We're going to start with this concert that's been planned for July 15th for the last six months, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of like that one. That's, I mean, you would have to, I don't know if you would, maybe you just wouldn't do it. Like, maybe you just, all right, we'll have a training camp of a week or two and let's just go play. I mean, that's what they do in college, right? They start the regular season pretty much right away. You know, the first game of Duke season is like the Champions Classic or whatever, like a big game against Kentucky. So it's not impossible to do it that way. I think maybe, what I had thought of was to do a kind of FIBA style end of the regular season where you take maybe the bottom eight teams in each conference and have them just all play a round robin. So they all play like seven games and then whoever wins that gets into the playoffs. Or you could do just, you know, the tournament for the bottom team to get the eighth seed as well. You could do it that way. Bottom eight teams in each conference. I guess a lot of it depends on like, if you were doing this, how much would you prioritize just in terms of fairness? What's already happened in the regular season versus let's just make this as entertaining as possible.
I think one, you want to make it as entertaining as possible. Two, like some of these bottom dweller teams, you kind of need to give them a reason to come back and give a shit. You know what
I mean?
If
honestly,
they're just like, hey, you're just going to play out the string for six games. Like, you know, like if you're Kevin Love, you're just like, you know what? I'm just going to hang out in California. Like, am I even going to bother coming back for that?
Yeah. Like, now, I do think if they're playing games with fans, if we're at that point, then I think there would be a lot of motivation, actually. I mean, we're going to be so miserable and so kept up. And just to actually celebrate the resumption of normal life by going to a basketball game and, like, cheering. I mean, even just to have a game, you know, in Atlanta, you know, Hornets, Hawks, I think people are going to just be, like, so happy to go to that game and just – like, so I think, if there are able to be fans in particular, like, I do think all 30 teams need to play, even if you're just sitting at home, right? I mean, number one, it's just a big chance for like everyone in these markets who's still sitting at home, if they're playing without fans, to just have something going on, right? I mean, like, this is, you've got a captive audience here, as morbid as this to say about that. Like, this is actually a chance for the league to really, take center stage. And I'm sure all the TV partners too would love to, like, think of, you know, if you're Fox Sports, Southeast for Atlanta, I mean, you still want to have those games, right? I mean, there's also just a chance to make money off these games a little bit and recoup some of these losses. So my personal preference would be, I think they should have, you know, all of these teams playing some games, but I do agree it'd be nice to, and I think just people would be so happy to be out there again and competing and like, you're also just trying to leave an impression for free agency and stuff. I actually think teams would play hard. Cause it's also like you're not beaten down for the end of the season. You're just cooped up with all your family and stuff for all this time. Like, you'd be so happy to just be playing. Like, these guys do love to play and you're not at the end of the season where it's like, I'm trying to get to Cancun after this. So I think teams would play hard, but I agree having more incentive would make it more interesting. So I it would be nice to have that for sure. So then, any other thoughts on like how we like create the playoff field here? I mean, like there's the tournament, there's doing like a FIBA style, you know, groups thing where each team plays each other and you get points. Or you could do this 30 team tournament that you were talking about, which I think would be pretty fun too.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the length of this all depends on how much time, how long their window really is to kind of blast through all this. And
yeah.
I'm sure the league is having the same kind of discussions. Like, if it really came down to it, could we play into September? Like, I mean, I think all that stuff has to be at least on the table right now as they talk it out and figure what the next steps are.
Well, here's what I'm thinking about, too. I mean, if we talk about the second scenario where they're starting, they can't start up until, like, August or September, I still think that they would want to finish out the season because, you know, playoffs are just more lucrative in general than regular season games. So even if you have to truncate next season, you'd rather finish this season. Also, it's just so weird to not have a champion for a season.
Yeah.
Now you might run into some issues with like the Players Association of like, hey, you know, we never had an off season. Would they accept the idea that, hey, your off season is when you were just sitting at home stuck in your house for 3 months? Like, you know, maybe not, but that's all of this is subject to negotiation. But I mean, for me, I would say even if it lasts into September, you should still do the playoffs if you can. I mean, and even if you're going up against football, but football, I mean, NBA can't start until September, football, you know, training camps, all this stuff like it, football is going to be retarded as well.
Yeah, I mean, a lot more contact with a lot more people in football too. So there's some things to think about in that sport.
So yeah, I think they should still. I mean, if it gets to be Christmas or something, then obviously, you know,
you reach the point that baseball did in '95, basically, where they just had to start up with the next season and be like, "Yep, sorry, Expos. Yeah. I know you were awesome, but too bad."
Yeah, well, and that was also where they didn't. It kind of made more sense to cancel it because they were doing it to themselves. I mean, this year, I think it would just be such a bummer for teams like the Bucks or the Clippers or the Lakers. I mean, gosh, for this crazy year they've had. So then what happens with like the end of the league year? Yeah. And the draft. I know you wrote a piece with Fassini about that. What did you guys come up with for what you think the draft is going to look like?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that they've lost every scouting opportunity, basically, right?
Yeah.
For the rest of the year, unless they push back the calendar on the draft, which, honestly, I mean, this is the one thing where the league really has as much control as it could ever want in terms of the only thing that's really in their way is the letter for players to put their name in or take them out for the next college season. That's the only deadline that really could get a little sticky, but that's, you know, that's an NCAA issue as much as it is an NBA issue. And even if that, you know, is a minor problem, I don't think they should be setting up the date of the draft based on that. Like, it's not that big an issue. And so given that, they can hold the draft basically whenever they want. If they want to hold the draft on August 12th, what's stopping them?
Yeah, that would also have to be negotiated, I assume. But
there's language on the draft in the CBA. Obviously, it would have to be negotiated. I think it's a pretty easy negotiation since you're negotiating with people who aren't going to be subject to the draft, right? Like that would probably be the easiest thing. They have a lot of stuff to negotiate based on some things that are in the CBA, and it's going to require some real partnership between the league and the Players Association. If it gets adversarial, it could really drag things out and get ugly. So hopefully that won't happen.
They're off to a good start. You know, they're off to a good start agreeing to this moratorium where, you know, there aren't going to be any changes in player contracts at all. That seemed like a good way to get rolling here. But yeah, I mean, it could get contentious. I'm actually going to have Larry Kuhn on my podcast tomorrow. We'll probably talk a little bit more about some of those issues. But so I mean, let's say scenario number one here, we're talking about a resumption June or July. What do you think would it happen in the draft? What do you think would be best to happen in the draft in that scenario?
I think you just have to separate the draft from the season at this point. Like, you just figure out when you can do the draft. And if the season's over by then, great. And if it's not, oh well. Because the two don't have to be connected, right? So, you know, you'll hold the lottery at some point and you can make a big deal about that. But that'll be based off of final regular season records, right? So as long as you're into that playoff season, you can get into the draft, and because you do want to at some point get the players drafted and get them into your, you know, the teams want to get them into their system and have a summer with them and whatever. So they are going to want to do that sooner rather than later. But I think the league just has a ton of flexibility here to do it when they want. And, you know, that should allow you in theory to do a real draft combine and have some players be able to work out for teams. And it could actually be beneficial that some of these European guys could come over and work out for teams too, which normally they can't because they're still playing their season.
Yeah, it does seem like it'd be tough though with just all the travel concerns to have like actual workouts. I mean, maybe it would make more sense to just, you know, again, congregate everybody in one area and sort of just have like an extended combine period. I mean, although that I, from a virology standpoint, I'm not sure whether that's better or having these prospects fly into the teams is better. Or I think more likely, honestly, I think we just would just have to not have individual workouts. Like they might have to just do it. Unless you get to the point where, again, we're just back to normal as a society. Yeah.
Back in the day, there were what we called group workouts, where basically three or more teams would sponsor a workout, invite every other team, and they'd have 15 to 20 prospects come in. Because that's the way you get around the six prospects on the court thing. The teams that were the most enthusiastic about those changed management. And so that hasn't happened in a few years.
Do you think there's any way they would do it before the actual season is over? Or do you just have to wait until afterwards?
I still think you need a season over so that you know the final records to do the reverse order for the draft. I mean, I suppose you could base it on records as of March 12th.
I mean, there's probably some anti-tanking.
Anti-tanking incentive like that better, there, right?
I mean, that's actually been proposed before to just do it as of some earlier date.
Yeah, there was actually a paper on that at the Sloan Conference, believe it or not.
Well, I think also it's just how the hell do you know what your team needs? How, like, the draft, you got to be able to make trades around the draft too. Like, I think it has to be after the regular season or after the playoffs are complete, right? I mean, like, you know, what if Giannis Antetokounmpo wants to get traded from Milwaukee because the Bucks go out in the second round and, you know, now like the draft has already happened. Like, you know, I mean, it does seem like it would have to be after whenever the playoffs are concluded. And that also has the benefit of presumably once you're actually playing playoff games, then things are back to normal enough that you can have more of a usual pre-draft process than you would earlier when you're still really worried about things.
Yeah, it depends how far back we go. I mean, if we're trying to play the finals in September, I still wonder about that.
Yeah, I mean, what everyone's going to be doing by that point. I mean, that's all. Yeah, I mean, we're going to know so much more in 2 weeks or a month from now, I think, of just like how wide this is really spread. But I do think when we're just talking about when can play actually resume, which is the biggest variable. Like 2 months to me seems like the absolute minimum, because if you look at the Chinese CBA, the lockdown really started on January 22nd in Wuhan, and they are like thinking about starting April 1st. So that's more than 2 months for them. And while certainly news reports would indicate that the initial response to the virus and letting it get out was totally bungled by the Chinese, they also really locked things down in a way that, frankly, we probably haven't yet.
Correct.
Not that I would prefer being there, because I've read a lot of really bad stories of what's happened to the people who have criticized the government response there initially. But they have locked things down more than we probably are. So you'd have to imagine that they, in terms of their society, if they're just feeling like they can restart again April 1st, we're probably going to be – it's going to be a longer timeline for us, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So that's – I mean – June, July is like the absolute earliest I would see things starting up again.
I think that's a fair estimate. Yeah. The amount we just wanted know to brighten is dwarfed by here. The amount we don't know, I should be clear. But based on what we do know, that seems like a fair estimate.
So I don't know. So you think you would, despite my concern, do you think you'd do the draft before the season is over? Like you'd, do you think that could be possible?
I'd be totally fine with that. I don't think it's that big a deal.
So what is the reason to not wait until longer, like I was saying?
I just think you hit a point where you need to get on with it. And all these all these players coming out are just hanging out, twiddling their thumbs. And you, when you, when you draft a guy, you do want to get him into your program and into your system and everything. And the longer that takes, if you basically lose a summer with them, you almost lose their first season too. I don't know, just coming from the team side, I guess that's how I would see it. So I would much rather be able to draft a guy in June than be able to draft him in September or October. But
yeah. Well, so what about the whole transactional element? You think that having the guy get into the team earlier is, I mean, it's also going to be weird to have a guy be drafted and then the playoffs are still going on and he's like, not participating.
Okay. So you raise a good point. There is a transactional element that would be blocked because the teams that were still playing could not do trades on draft night and the other teams could, and that could be perceived as unfair. So you raise an important objection that could be a real factor there that I had not considered.
Well, and also I think too, if we're at the point where they're playing in empty arenas, having the draft and having all the pomp and circumstance and the media and, you know, a crowd in the draft and stuff, like all of that, I think would probably be irresponsible if they're still playing in empty arenas. So that might be another thing, just to preserve the TV spectacle of it all, they would want to put it later.
True. Although, if things really get pushed back, having a draft is one of the few things that you can do.
That's actually something.
That's something, and you could just do it for TV, and you could, you know. So I guess it cuts both ways. But obviously, if that happened, you're doing it with no combine, you know, interviews via FaceTime. Like it would be the process for it would be unsatisfying for the teams involved, certainly.
Yeah. Well, although honestly, that might be true, but everyone suffers under the same constraints, right? I mean, I think eventually, as long as it's all fair and everyone has the same constraints, it doesn't bother me that much. I mean, you might say, hey, you know, as teens, we're more likely to make a bad decision because we didn't interview these guys or whatever, but nobody else is interviewing anyone either. So it should still be a level playing field. It'd be very interesting to see how hilarious would it be if, like, they don't do any of the pre-draft stuff, and this turns out to be like one of the most accurate drafts ever. They're just like only working off the film and the stats, and like they actually do a much better job.
Believe me, we've had those arguments internally about should you even do workouts, because the effect is so profound of that data point. Even if you allow yourself to, even if you continually remind yourself that it's just one data, it's so hard because it's the last thing you saw.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. All right, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll talk about how we would see a potential off-season unfolding. Well, we're going to be spending a lot of time at home over the next however long, and that's a great time to get started with Masterclass. Learn from the absolute best in whatever field you are interested in. Might as well buy their all-access pass, which you can get 15% off of. That gives you access to every masterclass at masterclass.com/PER. Easy to remember because John invented PER. Masterclass.com/PER gets you 15% off Masterclass. And whether you are just a polymath who wants to learn about a lot of subjects, or you really want to get into stuff, they've got exercises. You can get better at just about anything with their immersive learning experience. Cinema quality classes. Give you a list of a few of these. Annie Leibovitz teaching photography. That's a great thing you can go out and do on your own. Bunch of cooking classes. We're going to need those for sure. Natalie Portman teaches acting. Chris Voss on the art of negotiation. That's one that I may sit down and do here during this downtime. Of course, Steph Curry, shooting and ball handling. That's something you can practice on your own. Serena Williams, tennis. Alice Waters right here in my home of Berkeley, California. Created Chez Panisse, basically started farm to table in this area. She's got a class now. Really excited to try out all these because, let's face it, we're going to be at home. So the way to get started again with them, masterclass.com/PER. Don't forget that /PER URL to let them know that you came from us, and that'll get you 15% off their annual all-access pass. You guys know about The Athletic. We know you need your sports fix, and The Athletic is the best way to do this. They're still an essential resource for me right now. John is doing some great writing with them. He did a story just recently on what the draft might look like, what the league salary cap situation might look like with my partner, Danny LaRue. There's no ads, no pop-ups, no clickbait. All of the articles are stuff that sports writers can really take the time to get into. I think you're going to see some fantastic storytelling from them over these next few months now. The way to get started with them, theathletic.com/PER. Because remember, John invented PER. That can get you 40% off a yearly subscription and you get access to John's work, beat writers for basically every American team, great national writers like Shams Charania with the NBA, Jay Glazer for the NFL, my buddy Ethan Strauss here in the Bay Area, Sam Amick, David Aldridge, just a ton of NBA firepower. So once again, the way to get started with them, theathletic.com/PR. That'll get you 40% off a yearly subscription. It's a great way to support them right now, support journalism, and also get a great deal for yourself when the games start back up. That's theathletic.com/PER. So the analog that I thought of, you noted this when you went back to history of, you know, there's only been two seasons that have ever been canceled, the 1919 Stanley Cup Finals with, incidentally, the last big epidemic that we had, the Spanish flu epidemic, and then the 94 World Series, which was because of a labor stoppage. I wanted to pick a historical analog for what an off season might look like, and that's the 2011 lockout ending. Because okay. If you think about what is, because let's say, you know, we're playing the NBA Finals in September or something, presumably everyone would want to get started again with the next season as quickly as possible after that. Maybe you have a little bit of an off season, but you know, might want to try and do it by Christmas. So the question of what is the minimum amount of time you need to conduct an off season? 2011 is probably a pretty good analog there. They agreed, like, what was it? Early December, something so, like that. Yeah.
December 8th, they ended the lockout and they threw the balls up on December 25th.
Yeah, that's, and I think we can trust like today's player to stay in a little better shape than like, you know, the 1999 lockout player. I think by 2011, you know, you didn't really see any of these guys who'd ballooned up like Sean Kemp style. So the idea of like, oh, they need all this time to get in shape to play, that hopefully is something that wouldn't be a huge impediment. Yeah, I mean, they just basically got all their business done. The good news was the draft had already happened the previous year before the lockout. That helped them a lot, probably. So, yeah, I mean, how long do you think they realistically would have to take before starting the next season?
I think there'd be pressure from the teams that advanced deeply into the playoffs to have some time. And that tends to be the star players, too, who are pretty influential in the union. To me, the league's cut. We saw it in the 2011. The cutoff is Christmas for the league. They need those Christmas games.
Yeah. And
anything before Christmas, I think, is negotiable.
Yeah, that seems like what it. I mean, obviously, 99. They started in what, like end of January or something, and then you had the 50 game season with the, you know, back to back to backs, and I mean that season was just an absolute disaster. But I mean, the number of games that they had played too. Zach was talking about this on his podcast with Howard Beck of just like, you know, are we going to try to cram more games in now? Even like we even still did in 2012, or are you just going to keep the same tempo throughout the regular season? And hopefully to me, it would be the latter and it could be made up for by some more TV ratings, but it wouldn't be as good of a experiment as I was hoping for of like, you know, spreading 58 games over the entire regular season. So maybe they wouldn't get that much higher ratings.
Yeah, but a shortened season should produce higher ratings per game.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to make up for the games you missed. So that could be a point of contention for the league and for the players, honestly. I mean, you're talking about BRI, so you're talking about them getting paid prorated based on the number of games, basically. So there's a lot. Again, there's a lot to discuss here between the league and the Players Association. And it's tough to discuss any of it without more information.
Yeah, and I'm sure it seems like that the league probably hasn't even begun to think about this stuff yet because they're just trying to figure out like how they can get guys to work out and who might need to be tested still and what do we do if there's a positive test and how do we make sure more players don't get it in the midst of their self-quarantine or not quarantining as well as they should if that happens with some players or coaches or whatever. all of that seems like the more immediate concerns. And frankly, I mean, they're not going to be able to do anything until they have more information at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's when it does restart, though, I mean, it's going to be pretty fun. It's going to be awesome. Like I'm really, really looking forward to it. I mean, it's going to be such a whirlwind. It's going to be so unprecedented and new. I mean, it'll be more interesting than ever to me, and hopefully more interesting than ever to the public. Yeah.
I mean, we saw that. I mean, sort of the free agent feeding frenzy at the end of the last two lockouts, where these teams had to make so many decisions in such a short period of time. It was a really interesting few days, both in January '99 and in December 2011.
Yeah, I wish you'd been working for a team. I'd love to hear some stories from them. I mean, I know like Bobby Marks has talked about how the CBA comes down and they just like, all right, we're gonna stay up all night reading this thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've heard that from a couple other people who were there for it, that it was just insane.
Well, at least they won't have that issue this time. It'll be operating under hopefully a similar CBA. We'll see. And John did a nice piece with Daniel LaRue about what's going to happen with the salary cap, potentially with the lost revenue that's inevitable at this point. I'm going to have Larry Kuhn on the podcast as well to talk about that tomorrow, some of the real arcane CBA stuff. Biggest thing I wanted to do still, Danny and I did a podcast about just some of our favorite things about basketball. I thought to kind of remind ourselves of what's good in life, I would ask you the same thing. So I'm going to just pepper you here, John. For those who don't know you that well, this will be a nice window into your basketball history. So what is your favorite game that you've ever seen?
Favorite game that I've ever seen? Wow. I probably have to go Homer on this. Game two at Golden State, 2015, Mike Conley.
I was at that game.
The mask.
Yeah. What a performance that was. That was like after he'd broken his face in the Portland series. And I mean, just seeing him in the locker room. Do you remember?
I mean, I saw him. Yeah. I saw him at the hotel after the Portland game. So I was like, "Whoa!" You know, like just his. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, he broke his fucking face.
Yeah, like, exactly. It was just all blown up and discolored and whatnot, and he was kind of woozy from the drugs and stuff. And it was, and for him to come back and play so well in that game against that team and really put us in a position to, you know, to potentially steal the series that game. So I think, you know, that was probably the apex of that era of Grizzlies basketball. I know we got to the conference finals in 2013, but that 2015 team was our best team, so to speak. And yeah. That game was probably the pinnacle of it.
Yeah, I mean, that was just an unbelievable performance. I remember, I mean, he was just making all these floaters, like every time Golden State would try to come back, just ridiculous shots. And
the three at the end to put the nail in the coffin. Yeah.
I mean, like, do you remember, like, what did you talk to him at all about, like, how he was feeling at that time? Do you remember it?
Not really. You know, I remember talking to him during, you know, somewhere in that stretch, but I don't remember talking to him specifically before the game. It was just like, hey, I'm, you know, he's playing. It's like, okay.
Like that must have just been a shock to you guys that he was able to come back as quickly as he did, right?
Yeah, I mean, we just didn't know. And yeah. I guess we sort of assumed that it might be game, you know, maybe game four, maybe, you know, if we could get home and win game three, maybe we could have him for game four, maybe. So I don't think any of us thought game two. And obviously game one, people forget, we didn't have Beno Udrih either because he turned his ankle in the one game before Mike broke his face in that Portland series. So we were playing with Nick Calathes. We were able to win game five with him playing basically the whole game at point guard. And then game one against Golden State, we did the same thing. And so, you know, obviously it was, you know, no disrespect to Nick. He was a fine player as far as just being an NBA player, but it was a big uptick to go from him to Mike Conley.
All right. Your favorite player ever to watch?
Even though he played for our rivals, Manu Ginobili, not even close.
Wow.
Just so daring and creative, and like the one of those guys who struck the balance between being an absolute motherfucker on the court, but still a decent human being off it, which, you know, some guys struggle with. And I don't know. They call it the Euro step. I mean, he's from Argentina, but he's the guy who really brought it into play. And for him to be as good as he was and as talented as he was, and then accept the role he had for so long and thrive in it, I thought was really unique. I could watch him all day. I just thought he was a brilliant, brilliant basketball player. And just the way he played and the style was really unique.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most creative players of all time, I would say.
Yeah, and just, you know, he did stuff that people copy now. That you know, in terms of the Euro step, obviously, but even just little stuff. Like the Spurs had this play where they pass it to him way high on the wing, and then Parker would just cut through. And Ginobili just started firing these 40-foot bounce passes to Parker on his cut that, like, it wasn't even supposed to be part of the play, and they would get layups off it. And I don't know. It's there's something about, you know what I mean? Some guys you just, like, your eye just kind of goes to them, and when you're watching the play, and he's definitely that guy for me.
Yeah, and he wasn't, you know, an incredibly athletic player by conventional standards, but he brought a different type of athleticism, a change of direction, and just that wiry strength. And by the way, if you guys want to listen to it, I did Danny and I did all of our favorites for these as well on a pod last week. Favorite basketball memory.
Favorite basketball memory. Oh, I mean, it's got to be. I mean, can I include myself in this? Like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh, our high school team won the sectional championship. I mean, that was awesome. Yeah, yeah.
How many points did you score in that game?
I scored 5.
Yes.
there was a court storming at the end and everything, and guy on our team made the winning
upset?
Shot with 1 second left. No, it wasn't an upset. Wow. It was like the 1 seed versus the 2 seed, you know. But dramatic ending, and yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, I think because like people are always interested to hear how we actually fell in love with the game years ago before we became such jaded scribes or podcasters. In my case, yeah, that's. So were you guys, how did your season end that year?
The next round we played a team that was way better than we were, and we lost by like 20.
What was your game like as a high school player?
So I was one of the first 3-point specialists. They put in the 3-point line in 88 or 87 or something. And my senior year was like 89. As soon as they put that line in, I knew like, well, I'm not good at anything else. I'm going to be good at this. So I just started raining. I mean, I was a good outside shooter, but I would just shoot threes all the time.
Well, so you're ahead of your time analytically then, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think your 3-point attempt rate was in high school?
You know, it was probably like half my shots, something like that.
That's a lot for back then.
For back then is a lot, right? Yeah.
Did you have any like resistance to shooting threes from your coach?
Not especially. I mean, I would hear it from like other players sometimes. Like, why do you just keep shooting threes? I'm like, well, you know, I could step in and get 1 point less if you want. Would that make you happy? Like,
this is huge. This is the journey of John Hollinger into analytics. That you're ahead of your time, even as a high school player.
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you think that actually might have informed your approach a little bit?
Maybe a little bit. You know, I think I even didn't understand how overwhelming the math was. Like, I think I got it a little bit, but
just I think your, it wasn't public until... education wasn't that good.
It was a public school. I mean, what do you want?
It's 1.5 times more. I just didn't really understand it. You know, I just...
But also the spacing element of it too, I think, was the part that I think until later didn't really become as obvious.
Yeah, that's what I think people like. It really took until D'Antoni, I think, before, or maybe you could say like Houston, like those Tomjanovich Houston teams.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pitino was the first one to really, the first quote unquote famous coach to really adopt the 3-point shot, but yeah. I think he was doing it more just the math of the shot rather than the spacing element of it.
Yeah, I mean that, and that's really what it probably took. Really, even before, like from D'Antoni, and then really even I think those Heat teams to understand just like, oh wow, you spread everyone out, like everyone else has so much more space to work. I mean, there's this thought of like, okay, if you double team off of this guy, then, you know, now he can hit the shot. You know, there was that thought of like, okay, we want someone that we can't leave. Yeah. But the idea of like, no, you just are going to have more space overall to even run your initial play and make the help be further away. That, I think it took a long time for people to kind of get that.
Yeah, I agree.
The most awesome play that you've ever seen.
Okay, I'm going to go to college for this because I had a great seat for it. University of Florida scout seat, in before they redid their arena, was right along the sideline opposite the other team's bench. And you were it was a floor level seat. And so coming, I was about even with maybe the free throw line, and I'm basically right at the floor, and I'm watching Kentucky play Florida. Andrew Harrison, who was one of the players I was scouting, as you might have guessed.
So this is this 14-15 season?
Probably would have been, yeah.
Like I think he played 2 years, but is the
he played 2 years there? It wasn't the Anthony Davis year, obviously.
No, well, the 14-15 was they were about to be undefeated for the whole year, and then they lost to Kentucky in the Final Four.
Yeah, it was that year.
Towns was on the team
because it was their senior day. Actually, it was Florida's senior day for all those guys. Scotty Wilbekin and those guys. So Harrison comes down and throws a pass to Willie Cauley-Stein on the foul line, and he takes one step and soars up and just ends this dude's life. I mean, it's the best in-person dunk I've ever seen. It's not even close. And that to me is the most awesome play I've ever seen. And obviously, I had a bird's eye view for it, so that made it more like, you know, you could say LeBron's dunk on Iguodala or whatever. I was just watching that on TV. Like, so there's something visceral about being like sitting right on the floor and watching something like that, where you're like, oh my goodness.
For sure, being right there is huge.
So hopefully, there's a YouTube clip of this somewhere, which I'm sure there is.
Yeah, I would think so. I'm gonna try and find it actually after this. I'm gonna write that down, but. So you're saying like LeBron's block on Iguodala would be like another one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I told this story on the other podcast, but I want you to hear it actually. So I'm going to retell it. This was in Christmas of 1996. I was still a high school student, and I would just like go to high school games around my area just because I wanted to see some of these other teams play, and I didn't have anything better to do. It was over Christmas break. Our Christmas tournament had already concluded. Mm-hmm. So I went to Proviso West, which is a high school on the west side of Chicago.
Yeah.
In the suburbs. Robert Covington went there. Pretty good high school. A lot of good players have come out of there. And they had a Christmas tournament every year. And so there was a high school playing. It was like the last game of the night, first round. Nobody was in the arena. It was just like I was sitting, you know, probably halfway up in the stands. And a high school called Dunbar High School was playing. It was like a pretty good Chicago Public League team.
Oh, not the famous Dunbar from Baltimore then.
No.
Okay.
This is Dunbar High School in Chicago. And, you know, not like a powerhouse like the one that's in Maryland. And so a lot of these teams back then in the city that you would play against, they had like, you know, a bunch of just like 6 foot tall guys. And you would see them, you'd be like, oh, these guys like, aren't that good. And then the game would start and they would press. They would just dribble around you. They had like a couple of guys who could bomb threes and could jump out of the gym too. And these guys are all, you know, like 6 feet, like a buck 50. And they would just run us out of the gym when we'd play them. Yeah. And so I can't even remember what high school they're playing against, but there's maybe 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Dunbar's in control of the game. They're maybe up by like 10 or so. Guy goes up, misses a layup, and these two guys who are probably like 6 foot and weighed like a buck 30, both jump up, both get two hands on the ball, and both simultaneously tip dunk the ball.
Wow.
Breaking the backboard. This really happened. I swear to God.
Oh my God.
And there is maybe like, you know, if there were 150 people in the gym to watch this.
Yeah.
I was there with my friend Rory Donnie. I remember I'm not friends with him anymore. I'll have to actually see if I can get back in touch with him, ask him if he remembers this.
Okay.
But I've never seen anything like it. Like nothing like that will ever happen again. I mean, just how small those guys were to both get up, both tip dunk the ball at the same time, both grab the rim at the same time and break it. There was a 45-minute delay as they had to replace the backboard. I don't know where they found another backboard just sitting around at a high school gym, but they had one. It was unbelievable. I've like never just a random high school game as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure neither of those guys like ever really did anything in their basketball careers, probably. Yeah. But hopefully, they have that memory forever because it was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. Last question here. Your favorite team, non-Memphis division.
Favorite team, non-Memphis division. All right. I gotta get the year right here. The Phoenix Suns in 2010 maybe 2009 the year they played the 2010, conference finals against the Lakers.
That's 2010.
Okay. So I had the pleasure of covering that team's entire playoff run, and that was probably the best group of guys that have ever been on one team together. We talk about, we had Steve Kerr, Alvin Gentry, and Griff in the front office. Yeah, Steve Nash, Grant Hill, Jared Dudley, Robin Lopez, Jaren Collins, like just
Channing Frye was Channing on that Frye, team.
Like just great dudes everywhere, like all over the place.
Yeah, Jason Richardson was on that team too.
Yeah, yeah. That was just so much fun to be around that team. And obviously it was played a very attractive style too, obviously with Nash running everything and Dish and the way he did.
Dragic was on that team.
Dragic, they had
that Lou five Amundsen. Man bench unit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Leandro Barbosa.
Was he still on their team at that point?
Yes.
He might have.
Yeah.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was at that game where Dragic scored 24 points in the fourth quarter or whatever it was against San Antonio. Just covered them all through those first two rounds in some of the conference finals, and just a great group of guys. I don't know. It was just a fun team to watch, and, you know, you really wanted them to do well. Other than Amin, obviously. But we kid, Amin's a friend of the show. But he was in the Suns organization at that time.
Did you know him at that point?
No, I did not actually.
Yeah, that's, Amin's rise from obscurity is just like a wonderful story.
Yeah.
You probably weren't talking to like,
I didn't talk to the video coordinators, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he had moved into front office by that point, I want to say, but, yeah, no. And then it all went awry. Like they decided not to give Stoudemire a contract, which, you know, was probably a decent decision. And Kerr ended up leaving and Griff ended up leaving. And, yeah. Then the Lance Blanks era started, and wasn't quite the same.
Not quite, no, no.
No, that was a team, because I lived in Arizona for a long time in law school. I shouldn't say a long time, it was 3 years, but and really liked that team. So I followed their playoff run. I was really rooting for them, and then they got ended by Kobe with like a ridiculous barrage of shots in that game six.
Exactly, yeah.
Just like he just hit, like he was just getting double teamed and hitting like 22-foot fadeaways over and over again from the right wing. All right. So I guess we got to take our medicine here and talk a little bit, since we do have this platform, and I wouldn't feel right if we weren't at least trying to talk about, what's going on with COVID-19. So I'll tell you what, you guys know I'm incredibly lazy about writing. this crisis is so important that I actually wrote something. if that doesn't impress the gravity of the situation upon you, nothing will.
There you go.
So what I talked about was, and I pinned this to my Twitter profile, you know, obviously there's a lot of discussion about social distancing. And I imagine that if you are listening to this podcast, you've been in the news enough. You're probably someone who has been doing that yourself. And we know why that's so important, even if you yourself are healthy, to flatten the curve, avoid our hospitals getting overwhelmed with this initial surge. And of course, to prevent transmission to more vulnerable members of society. And also you too probably don't necessarily want to get this thing. I would say we don't really know that much about it right now. So important to socially distance. But I think the greater thing that all of us who already realize the importance of that is to reach out to people that you know personally and try to talk to them about why they should do this. So the article that I wrote was based on some of my experiences, my wife's experience with her, one of the yoga studios that she teaches at, where she reached out to them and there was a lot of resistance at first, understandably so, because the business that she worked at, they felt a responsibility to their employees. They wanted to remain in business. They knew that their employees rely on the business for their livelihood. And basically she tried to impart to them, like, no, like we need to, like, is our social responsibility to shut down. Yoga studios can transmit this virus really well. And so based on her experiences, I wrote a guide for talking to either the business owner of the business that you work at, if you're worried about contracting the virus and it's not, you know, something that's essential for people to live their lives. Obviously those people we need to protect and they have to be out there. So everyone else shouldn't be. So I strongly encourage you guys to take a look at that. If you are a business owner, it's got some good stuff in there about why you really should consider closing things down as well, because it seems like it's going to be coming anyway at this point. And so this next week or two is going to be essential to flattening the curve. So, like, honestly, I think all of us, I encourage everyone on my show, I'm encouraging everyone now, talk to 10 people in your life today, every day, who you think could be learning more about this, and just try to be good about persuading them. They're not monsters because they're doing this. They're trying to live their lives. They don't understand it. They're not selfish. They're not bad people. We were all in the same spot that they were a week ago. And so I needed to hear it from someone in my life, and they probably need to hear it from someone in their life. And, you know, even if you don't think that people are going to get it right away, they probably aren't going to get it right away. Just keep working on them. That's what I think we all need to do here.
And with, I should add, with St. Patrick's Day coming up, some states have closed bars already, but for those of you who are thinking of going out and going to a packed bar for St. Patrick's Day, I would strongly recommend you not do that. That is an incredible way to be a super spreader, and you won't know it until it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
Disease works.
That's the thing to remember, is that a lot of people, I mean, that's why we're having so much trouble with this, that there are a lot of asymptomatic carriers of this. I saw a good piece of advice, which is basically don't be concerned about getting the disease. We all need to act right now as if we all have it already, and that exactly. And many of us might. That's the way we have to act for at least, you know, the next couple of weeks, until we understand what's going on here, because it could be beyond what anyone really understands as far as how far it's spread already. And I think, you know, we've seen with governors and the National Institute of Health, and even President Trump saying he supported Apple closing down their stores. He supports businesses who have made the decision to close. So I think this is something that everyone is aligned on at this point. And, you know, if you know friends who are going out to bars, suggest to them that, hey, let's all do a virtual hangout instead. We'll have a few beers together, you know, while we're talking to each other online. We got to just find ways to do things differently for a while. So again, I strongly recommend you guys read that article. Please share it if you can. Talk to business owners, talk to people who need to hear this in your life. I mean, if we have to be more viral in our habits to stay ahead of the virus itself, and that's going to be really difficult. So we got to all, really, if you talk to 10 people and you can get them to talk to 10 people, and that's the biggest thing to me, is it's not just doing it yourself. You now have to get other people to do it too, in the most compassionate way that you possibly can. Anything else? Did I miss anything there? Anything?
I think you pretty much covered it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that I've seen a couple of people say, you know, oh, well, this disease isn't going to, shouldn't change the way we live our lives. And I think that's like that kind of that 9/11 mentality. But you're like, we're fighting a germ now and yeah. You're the bomb. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, it's, I would say this to a lot of us who listen to this too. I think most of the people who listen to this, just in terms of demographics, are like-minded here. And a lot of times that our normal methods of persuasion, you all see this on Twitter, for example, you know, just, oh, hey, we're making fun of people who are still going out, or just we're treating these people as monsters, or we're sharing an article that, you know, I mean, the ones that are informative are really good, but, you know, sharing a meme that like makes fun of the people who are still going out. And I think that that kind of persuasion is, that's kind of what we do with politics. And a lot of people who, you know, frankly, a lot of people who listen to this are liberal. That's the way my politics go. I'm not as active politically on Twitter as some people are, but I don't think that that kind of persuasion is what's going to actually resonate with people here. Like, it needs to be understanding. It needs to be fact-based, and it needs to be personal. It needs to be actually talking to the people in your life that aren't doing this one-on-one, not in a public sphere, not in a way that's going to embarrass anyone, in a way that acknowledges that you yourself recently came to this conclusion. You recently had this transformation. If you act like, holy shit, this is so obvious and these morons aren't doing it, like, that doesn't persuade anybody to change their behavior. Like, that's not how you get through to people. And so I think a lot of people kind of do that when it comes to politics. And what you're doing there is you may be signaling yourself that you are part of this to your own in-group, but that doesn't help at all. Like, those are the people who are already doing this. Like, you need to reach the out-group, and you need to reach out to people as opposed to just trying to make the people who are doing this feel like crap. Like, that doesn't, maybe 2 months from now, that kind of social shaming will be fair and will work. But right now, we just, like, this is all moving so quickly. It seems like we've all known this for so long, but we've only been here for a matter of days ourselves. And we need to be sensitive to that with the people who haven't realized these things yet. And especially people who are still trying to do the right thing by living their lives and keeping their business open for the sake of their employees. And I think we just need to trust that these other people are, come at it from the standpoint that these people aren't being selfish monsters who don't give a shit about everyone else. Like, they're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to live their lives the way they can, and try to be compassionate to that as you persuade people.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be back next week. And, certainly we are be very open to suggestions for like fun pods that we can do at this point that you guys want to hear. Any questions that you guys want to ask John? I mean, we're lucky enough to have John's vast repository of knowledge. So we'll be mining him for stories about his Grizzlies days, and he'll just sort of try not to say too much while I grill him.
Yeah, that'll be a fun dance.
But yeah, we're going to have a lot of interesting stuff to get to here, and we hope that you will stay with us, and we hope that you all stay safe. So till next time.